Okay, so any questions from the previous lectures? Okay, so I have put another link in the course website for some randomized algorithms. So, in fact, some of the material we already talked about and some of the material that we will be talking about, they will all be in the lecture notes. So I have put a link to those. So in fact, I'll try to put some notes from somewhere or the other to cover all the topics that we do in the class. So that's kind of me. Okay, so any questions?
Where okay. Do you find your book, the book that you suggested?
Which book are you
talking about? The book that you mentioned for this class.
Oh, I said some lecture notes, right?
Yeah, where can we get the book?
Oh, is that a book?
Your book.
Oh, my book, I see. I think that should be readily available.
I saw there is two references. One of them is the scalar, the
right.
Second one is your book, right?
Right. Now, if you keep it as a secret, you can find the PDF online.
Oh, really? But yeah, the PDF is from 1998, something like that. But you said...
That's a 2008... I think the 98 should be okay, because, I mean, there are some revisions, but for the most part, that should be right. Exactly, right. So yeah, that'll be a copyright violations, but I did not tell you, so. Okay, so any other questions or comments? So last time we were talking about the selection problem. So selection problem is one where we are given a sequence of numbers and one integer I, and we want to identify the I smallest element. And then we talked about the quick select algorithm, where I pick one of the elements as a partitioning element, partition the input into two, and check if the partitioning element is the I smallest element. If so, we are done. Otherwise, we do a recursive selection either in the first part or in the second part. So that's the quick select. In the worst case, that can take n square time. But we can show that on the average, it only takes linear time. So the average being in the space of all possible inputs. Now we can immediately convert this into a randomized algorithm, as you suggested, by picking a random element as a partitioning element, in which case the same proof will go through, and then you will infer that the expected runtime of the algorithm is linear, where expectation is in the space of all possible outcomes for the coin flips. Now, one question was whether one could do linear time in the worst case, deterministically, and such an algorithm was proposed by Blum, Floyd, Pratt, Rivers, and Tarjan, wherein they basically modified the quick select by picking a partitioning element in an appropriate manner. That's the only twist. And then once they find the partitioning element, they'll go and use the quick select. So that's how the BFPRT algorithm is. The way to pick the partitioning element would be by grouping the input into groups of size 5 each. So if you call them as, say, K1, K2, K3, the first five elements belong to, say, the first group, and the next five elements belong to the second group, K6, K10, and so on. And then there will be the final group. As the Mithal laws of generality, the last group also has five elements. So you see the K10. So we group them, and then we find the median of each group. Find the, so let the groups be G1, G2, G5, and then we find the median of each group. So let's give some names to that. by T sub I. So that is step number one, and step number two will be recursively the median of these medians. Median M of M1 into M1. And step number three is run quick select. M as the partitioning. So up to here, that is a new portion of the algorithm. And from here, we have already seen the subject. So that's how the BFPRT algorithm works. Now let's see what the runtime of the algorithm is. Notice that there are two recursive calls. One is to find the median of the medians. And there is another recursive call here in the worst case, because I take the M as the partitioning element, partition the input, original input into two, X1 and X2. So in the worst case, I may have to recursively do a selection either on X1 or on X2, right? So therefore, in the worst case, there could be two recursive calls. So that's something you need to keep in mind. Let's write the recursive list for the runtime and then we will solve it, right? So, runtime. As usual, we'll say let TFN be the runtime on any input of size. And for any I. So we want to take the worst case across all possible values of I. So that being TFN, let's write a recurrence relation for this, and then we will solve that. Okay, so we have to look at every step and then account for the time. Okay. The first step, we want to group the elements, input elements into groups of size 5 each and find the median of each group. So how long will that take? So if I give you 5 elements, I can find the median of the 5 elements in how many comparisons? For example, I can do find the smallest of the 5 elements. That will cost me 4 comparisons. Then I'm left with 4 elements, then I find the minimum of the 4, which will cost me 3 comparisons. Then I'm left with 3 elements, I find the minimum. That is the median, that will cost me 2 comparisons. Therefore, for every group, I spend 9 comparisons. That's kind of the trivial algorithm. I don't know if there is a better algorithm, but we don't care about the constant right now. Right? So, step 1 takes n over 5 groups. For each group, I take 9 comparisons. I can say less than or equal to, because somebody comes up with a better algorithm than that. So that is step number one. And how about step number two? Step two takes, right, this is a recursive call. So therefore, what will be the runtime of this? Step two will cost me, it's a recursive algorithm, right? So therefore, it will be, the runtime will be a function of capital T. So it will be capital T of n over 5, because there are n over 5 elements. As far as the T of n is concerned, I just want to know how many elements I have for my selection. And I don't care what element I am selecting. So I don't care about I. So just tell me how many elements you have, then the runtime is dictated by that, because we are looking at the worst case. So that will be T of n over 5. So now, step number three. So how long does this take? Right? So we have to now get an idea of how many elements will there be in X1 and how many elements will there be in X2. Think about the following situation where I pick the partitioning element, which is exactly equal to the median of the n elements. In which case, what will be the size of x1?
N over 2.
That will be excellent. Of course, finding the median itself is the most difficult problem, as we have been saying all along. But what is good about this algorithm is that if I pick the partitioning element in this manner, it is going to ensure that the size of x1 and size of x2 will be very closely equal to n over 2, right? Roughly equal to half of the elements. And therefore, this can be thought of as an example of a deterministic sampling. We know what we mean by random sampling, right? I just randomly pick some number of elements as elements. I call that as a random sample. Whereas in this case, it's kind of very similar to random sampling. We just group the elements into groups of size 5 each, and then we find the median of each one of them, and find the median of those medians. And we expect that this would be probably very close to the median of the n elements. Right? That's kind of the intuition. Right? We can actually show that the size of x1 is no more than 7 tenths of n, and the size of x2 is no more than 7 tenths of n. So let's prove that. Now, what is x1 and what is x2? Those are the two parts that the quick select is going to generate for me, right? So I have my partitioning element m, I have my input x, and I partition the input into x1 and x2 using m as the partition. And that's x1 we are talking about. So let's see why this is true. So let's look at one of the groups. So let gi be any group. We will prove that, right? We have not, so we are in the, we are going to prove that.
Okay.
Because for every group, we can find the median of 5 elements in 9 comparisons. Right? So if you just give me 5 elements, and if I'm asked to find the median, I can use the trivial algorithm, right? Wherein I find the minimum of the 5 elements in 4 comparisons, then I'll be left with 4 elements, then I find the minimum of those 4, that will cost me 3 comparisons, then I'm left with 3 elements, I find the minimum of the 3, and that is the median I want, and therefore a total of 9 comparisons. Okay, so let gi be any group for which the median is less than or equal to m. For which m sub I is less than or equal to capital M. So I have a group, there are 5 elements. And here is my median of that group. And I'm told that this is less than or equal to. So in this group, can I say that there are at least 3 elements which are less than or equal to m? Right? Because by definition, this is a median of that group. Therefore, there are 3 elements less than or equal to the median, m sub I, which in turn is less than or equal to capital M. Therefore, there are at least 3 elements in GI which are less than or equal to capital M. Right? So G has at least 3 elements less than or equal to. Is that agreed? Yes. Any questions on that? Possibly this could be less than or equal to M as well. This could be less than or equal to M as well. But we do not know. But we know for sure that there will be at least 3 elements which are guaranteed to be less than or equal to M. Right? So that is one observation. Now, how many groups are there whose medians are less than or equal to M? So the number of groups whose medians are less than or equal to M. n over 10, excellent, right? Is that agreed? By definition, capital M is the median of those medians. So therefore, exactly there are n over 10 groups whose medians will be less than or equal to capital M, right? So that is another operation. That is equal to n over 10.
Why is
it? I'm sorry. Oh, because capital M is the median of those medians, right? So by definition then, if I look at the medians, let's say I look at the medians in sorted order, M1, M2, M, n over 10, M, n over 10 plus 1, M, n over 5. So if I, let's say these are the medians in sorted order, then by definition, this will be the median. So the number of elements less than or equal to this median will be basically these elements.
But there were five groups, right? Why is there 10 medians?
Oh, because I'm talking about the median of those n over 5 elements.
It's like this, it's n over 5 divided by 2.
2, right, yeah. So that's the definition of the median, right? So I have n over 5 medians, and I'm looking at the median of those medians. So that means there are half elements which are less than or equal to the median, half elements greater than or equal to the median. So that's why we have n over 10 groups which are going to have a median less than or equal to n. And in each one of them, we have found at least 3 elements less than or equal to m, right? Therefore, in the original input, we have identified at least 3 10 n elements which are guaranteed to be less than or equal to n. So that means that the size of x1 is greater than or equal to 3 10. Because by definition, x1 has all the elements that are less than or equal to, that are strictly less than the median of medians. So which in turn means that the size of x2 is less than 7 times. So we have, if I pick the partition element in this manner, then I know that x1 has at least 30% of the elements. Therefore, x2 can have at most 7 tenths of elements.
So, here you said fact, size of x1 is like 7 tenths.
Yeah.
Should it be 3 tenths?
We can use the same argument to prove the other part as well. This shows that x2 is no more than of size 7 tenths of n. A similar argument holds to show that x1 also has no more than 7 tenths. So therefore, we are ready to calculate the time for step number 3. In the worst case, we know that I have to recurse either on x1 or on x2. In the worst case, I only have to spend time that will be t of 7 tenths of n. Right? So this means that step 3 is t of 7 tenths. So we can add these up and get our final recurrence solution. So therefore, the reconciliation looks like this. C times n, C being a constant. So there are two places where we have the linear time. One is to find the median of the individual groups. That will cost us, as we said, 1.8 times n. And also, when we do the quick select, we have to partition the input into two. That will cost us n comparisons. Right? Therefore, you have to add those two. That will be 1.8 plus 1, 2.8 n. So I just call it as c times n, c being a constant. If you can do better than 2.8, then you get a better constant. Right? So let's keep it as c n. So that's a reconciliation. Unfortunately, we cannot use Master theorem because Master theorem can only tolerate one occurrence of the function t on the right-hand side. We have two of them. So one can try to do repeated substitutions, but that also will become messy. So herein, we can use the proof by induction. Right? So the way proof by induction works is I get a solution to the reconciliation, and then I'll try to give a proof by induction. So if it goes through, it means what? That what I have is an upper bound for the solution. Then I may want to be a little bit more adventurous and try something less than what I started with and try to see if the proof goes through. And so there's a little bit of a trial and error. So in this case, of course, we have to come up with a guess, and we know what the guess should be, right? So we know that some constant times n, and then try to see if the proof goes through. If the proof goes through, we know that that is the best we can do because, you know, we need at least linear time. Even just to partition the input into two, I need linear time. Therefore, asymptotically, I cannot do better. So here is our induction hypothesis. So proof by induction. Our induction hypothesis says the following: that Tfn is less than or equal to d times n for some constant d. In fact, the good thing about proof by induction is that if the proof goes through, then we will also be able to fix any constants that we might have assumed in the hypothesis. In this case, we don't know what d is. If the proof goes through, we will get to know what d is. Right? So that's a good one. So as usual, a proof by induction, we will have a base case, and we are lazy enough to omit that. I'll just say the base case is easy. And not worry too much, and concentrate on the induction stuff. Induction step, as we know, we'll assume that the hypothesis is true for all inputs of size up to n minus 1, and we will prove it for n. So assume the hypothesis for all inputs of size less than or equal to n minus 1. We'll prove it for n. So the truth is this one, so we'll start with that. So Tfn is less than or equal to Tfn over 5 plus Tf 7 times n plus c times n. Where c is known, it's a known constant. But the way we did this, c is 2.8. c is a known constant, but d is not. So let's apply the hypothesis. Applying the hypothesis. So n over 5 is strictly less than n, so which means that it is no more than n minus 1, and this is also no more than n minus 1, therefore I can apply the hypothesis. So Tfn is less than or equal to d times n, so d times n over 5 plus d times 7 tenths of n plus c times n. The question is the right hand side less than or equal to cn? If so, for what values of d would that happen? Right? That's what we want to check. So this will be, so let's simplify this a little bit. This is 0.2 plus 0.7, that's going to give me 0.9 times dn plus c times n. So the right hand side will be, our hs will be less than or equal to d times n. If 0.9 times dn plus cn is less than or equal to d times n. So which means what? So if I cancel the d's all over and take this to the other side, 0.1d is greater than or equal to c, and ed is greater than or equal to d times c. In other words, the proof will go through if my d is at least 10 times c, which means what? That the solution for the recurrence relation is 10 times t of n equals 10 times cn, right? That's the solution that we end up with. So this means that t of n is less than 10 times cn. And if I substitute c to be 2.8, this will give me 28 times n, which is theta of n, a linear time algorithm in the worst case. So that's a very nice algorithm that BFPRT came up with. So if you look at the five names, it's a very nice paper because out of the five people, three of them got Turing Award. Right? Blum got the Turing Award, Rivest, and Tarja. So the three of us. Out of the five authors, three of them got the Turing Award. So that's why it's a nice paper in that sense as well. Any questions? Okay.
I don't understand the applying the hypothesis step.
I'm sorry.
How did we get from applying the hypothesis to right hand side is less than?
Right. So we applied the hypothesis to each one of them, right? And our hypothesis says that T of n is no more than D times n. So therefore, T of n over 5 will be no more than D times n over 5.
Uh-huh.
And likewise, T of 7 tenths of n is no more than D times 7 tenths of n.
Right. And then when we did right-hand side, is less than or equal to Dn.
Right. So the right-hand side is basically this one, right? 0.9 Dn plus Cn.
Mm-hmm.
And when would this be less than or equal to Dn? I want to show that this is going to be less than or equal to Dn. If I can show that, that means the proof goes through.
Okay.
And then I check, okay, when would that happen? That would happen if this is true, meaning D is at least 10 times C. So which in turn means that the proof goes through if I have a value for D which is at least 10 times C. And therefore I don't have any reason to go anything beyond that. I will just choose that value for my D, which is 10 times C. Even if I have 20 times C, the proof goes through, but I'm trying to show that my runtime is as small as possible. Therefore, this is the smallest value for D for which the proof will go through. Then, okay, I'll take that. I'll take that as my runtime, or the solution for the runtime.
And why does that have to be less than or equal to Dn for the proof to go through?
Because otherwise, the right-hand side will not be less than or equal to D times N.
Why does that have to be true?
Because when we want to check if this is the case, then we just basically simplify and realize that if this has to be true, then this has to be true, and this has to be true.
Right. But I'm wondering more about why do we have to prove that right hand side is less than or equal to dn for the proof?
Because that's how any proof by induction goes through, right? So proof by induction, we would assume a certain hypothesis. And we'll first verify the hypothesis for small values of n, which are the base cases. And then followed by that, we will do the induction step. The way induction step is done is, assume that the hypothesis is valid until, say, up n minus 1 for inputs of size up to n minus 1. Under that assumption, we will prove that the hypothesis is also true for an input of size n. Okay, that's what we have exactly done. So we wanted to check, or we wanted to prove that T of n is also less than or equal to Dn to complete the proof by induction.
Okay.
because I have assumed the hypothesis until n minus 1, and I'm trying to prove it for n.
N or TFM?
N.
Oh, okay.
Meaning TFM, right? So my hypothesis for any input of size n is this one. And I have assumed that it is valid for all the values of input size up to n minus 1. Meaning T of n minus 1 is less than or equal to d times n minus 1. T of n minus 2 is less than or equal to d times n minus 2. So I have assumed all of that. Under that assumption, I'm trying to show that T of n is also less than or equal to d times n.
I see.
So that's a part B. Any other questions? Okay, so this is the runtime of the BFPRT algorithm. Now, followed by this paper, many, many papers have been written wherein they try to improve that constant, you know, from 28 and tens of papers. The algorithm became more and more complex. And to the best of knowledge, the best known constant happens to be something like 2.2n, and it's a fairly complex algorithm. As opposed to that, we are going to look at a randomized algorithm, which is whose constant is the smallest possible, the absolutely smallest possible. And that's what we want to discuss next. So any questions? So here is the algorithm. This algorithm was proposed by Floyd and Rivers, two of the authors of that BFPRT.
So why this randomization works? Like, inverse algorithm that's very complex and bring the constant down. And if you take a simple randomization, it works better than that. Why is that?
Oh, that's the power of randomness, right? If you look at the literature on algorithms in general, there are two aspects of randomness which people have identified repeatedly. One is they invariably bring simplicity, right? If you look at the best randomized algorithm versus the best deterministic algorithm, the randomized algorithm will be much, much simpler than the deterministic algorithm. And more often than not, the asymptotic time complexity of the randomized algorithm will be better than that of the deterministic algorithm. And more importantly also, if you implement them, then this algorithm really performs the best, right? Now, then why should we care about deterministic algorithms at all? You know, there are people who are skeptical. You know, even, you know, 99.99999% probability, you know, I may not be able to sleep with that kind of probability, then of course I must go for a deterministic algorithm. So that's where I think the choice lies in, do I strongly believe in randomness? There is so much of reason to believe in randomness, but you know, there are some people who cannot be convinced, even with, you know.
Isn't this like a pacemaker or something where even though it goes wrong, once someone's dead?
Yeah, you know, like, you're right. Oh yeah, that's, you know, like if you talk about a Monte Carlo algorithm, right? And if that probability of me dying on a given day is, you know, 10 to the power minus 1,000, but still that with that probability, I cannot sleep, then, you know, I should go for a deterministic.
I mean, that probably exists even if it's deterministic because there.
You're right. You know, there are other things that come into picture, right? I mean, what is the probability that you die on a given day with an accident on the road, the probability will be 10 to the minus, you know, 10 or something like that. So it's much more likely for me to die on the road than my algorithm failing and killing me, right? So that is that. Okay, so let's talk about the randomness algorithm. This is what I'm going to describe is not exactly the same algorithm. So what I'm going to present will be a simplified version of that algorithm with exactly the same time bomb. So here is the idea of the randomness. Now before that, there is a lower bound which says the following. I will state that and then we will achieve that lower bound, or very close. Any selection algorithm in the worst case needs n plus min of I comma n minus I comparisons. to a finding. Oh, it's months. So this is the lower bound. No matter what algorithm you use, in the worst case, I need these many comparisons. Now, this also tells us something about the median being the most difficult problem, right? Because this is the largest when I equals n over 2. So which is what I have been saying all along, that finding the median is the most difficult. And in fact, our randomness algorithm will make exactly the same number of comparisons plus some little of n, probably something like n to the 2/3, that's a little of n, which is much, much less than n. So this is how the algorithm works. So I will call it as a Floyd and reverse algorithm, even though, as I said, what I'm going to present is slightly different. So the way the algorithm works is as follows. Namely, we can think of many randomized algorithms along the lines of what we have already discussed. Namely, for example, I can pick 5 elements or 11 elements at random, pick the median of those 11 elements as the partition element. You know, those kinds of variations will always help in practice. And so this will be something along those lines, but slightly different from the straightforward approach of using randomness. So this is how the algorithm works. It's going to pick a random sample to begin with. Of, say, S elements. Sample capital S of S elements from the input. And in the random sample, I'm going to pick, identify 2 elements, L1 and L2, such that the ith smallest element of X is going to have a value in between L1 and L2 with a high probability. And that's one condition. The other condition is, if you ask me how many elements are there, input elements are there, whose values fall in between L1 and L2, that number is not very large. So these are the two conditions I want to satisfy. So I'll pick 2 such elements from the sample. And then once I identify the 2 elements, I will eliminate all the input elements that do not fall in between L1 and L2. And then presumably what I'm going to be left with is not very large, then I will do a selection on that. So that's how the algorithm is done. So I pick 2 elements from the sample, which will bracket the element I want to identify with a high probability. Moreover, the number of input elements falling in between L1 and L2 will be not very large. So that's how the algorithm is going to work. So let me write it on that. So identify 2 elements from S. Such that they are going to bracket the element we want to identify. Such that the ith smallest element, so if you call the elements, let's say L1 and L2. Is going to have a value in between L1 and L2. And the cardinality of the following set, Q in X is such that L1 is less than or equal to Q is less than or equal to is small. And then you will define what it means next time. If I only have the first condition, namely, I want to find two elements which will bracket the element I'm interested in identifying, that is very easy to do, right? What would be one way of doing that?
First and last
element. Excellent. So L1 could be the smallest of the input element, and L2 could be the largest of the input elements, right? I mean, those are useless elements, because what is the point in, you know, identifying those two elements? Our goal is to find a very small subset of the input which is going to have the element I'm interested in finding, then I'm going to do a selection on that, right? That's the big picture. The big picture is pick a small subset of the input elements which is going to have the element I'm going to look for, and then after having made sure that indeed the subset has the element I'm looking for, then I go and do a selection on that, right? That's kind of the summary of the element. So that's why we require that the size be very small. And the reason being that I first identify L1 and L2, and then I throw away all the elements that do not fall in between L1 and L2. And within the remaining set of elements, I do my selection, right? So that's what I want. That's why I want to make sure that this set is not very large in size. Okay, so how do I find those two elements? Make a definition. The rank of an element. Rank of an element in a set is defined as the number of elements in X such that Q is less than K. Less 1. That's how we define the rank of an element. So in other words, of course, we assume that K is an element of X. So if I...
Triangle equal, I've never seen that before.
Oh, defined as.
Oh.
So yeah, this means that defined as. Have people seen that notation before? I think some of you have seen. So that's the definition of the rank. So the rank is nothing but the position of the element if I sort the sequence, right? For example, the smallest element has a rank of 1, and the largest element has a rank of n, and the median has a rank of n over 2. That's how we define it. So I'm going to pick two elements in the sample whose ranks will be the following. Pick L1 to be element of S whose rank in S is I times smallest over N minus square root of 4 alpha log N. And pick L2 to be the element of S
five S
alpha log n, where that alpha, remember, is always the probability parameter. So when we say high probability, we mean a probability of at least 1 minus n to the minus alpha. That's where the alpha comes in.
Dr. Rao,
yeah.
Does that say I alpha over n?
I times S over n.
Oh, got it.
S is the sample size. So I times S over n plus square root of 5 alpha S log n. So these are the two elements. Now one simple question is, here is my random sample. I pick an element whose rank is so-and-so. Can you say something about the rank of the element in the original input? So here is my original input, x, and then I pick a sample out of that, yes. And then, okay, let's say the rank of an element here, I call that element as so q. The rank of q in s equals, let's say, j. Right, in the set. So roughly speaking, there are j elements which are less than or equal to q in the sample. Right? Now, can we say something about the rank of the element in the big set, in the original set, in the expectation? Right? What would be the expected rank of this element in the big set? I'm sorry. So I want to know the expected value of rank of q in x.
The first element should be the first quartic, and the last element should be the last quartic.
Okay, so let me say this in a different way. So when we say the rank of q in S is j, that means there are j elements which are less than or equal to that element in this set. Now I want to ask the same question. How many elements will I expect to see in X which are less than or equal to q?
At least j.
I'm sorry?
At least j elements.
At least j, for sure. In terms of expectation, can we say something different? Excellent. J times n over s, right? So because I want to see a proportionally larger number of elements in the original set. Because I picked a random sample from here. And so if there are j elements less than or equal to in here, then I would expect to see a proportionally larger number of elements. That is what we call as n over s times. Okay, so that is the expected value. And that is the reason, for example, so if I apply that here, I would expect the rank of L1 in the original set to be I minus something, and the expected rank of L2 will be I plus something. So therefore, in expectation, the I smallest element is going to fall in between L1 and L2, right? That's the intuition behind this. So I pick two elements whose ranks will be, one of them will have a rank less than I, another one will have a rank greater than I. Then I'm going to bracket the I smallest.
Guarantee we'll get that from a random sample?
Right, exactly. So let's prove that with a high probability that is going to happen. Right. You're right. So we have to prove that this happens with a very high probability. Okay. So any other questions? That's kind of intuition behind picking those two elements, right? Any questions? Okay.
I don't understand the intuition we're describing is that the two elements L1 L2 will be bracketing the I element. But as for the expectation part, what are we saying there for those two?
What we are saying is that the expected rank of L1 is strictly less than I, and the expected rank of L2 is strictly greater than I. Okay?
We just proved that.
Expectation is easy, right? Because expectation you just proportionally multiply. But we have to show that with a very high probability that happens.
Got it.
Yeah, that we have not done yet. So we will do that.
Okay.
Okay. So any other questions? Okay.
How are we going to choose I?
How are you going to choose L1?
I
remember is the input to S. I want to find the I-th smallest element.
Okay.
That's the I that I have. And what is the value of S? We will discuss that in a minute. So the value of S will be something like n to the 2/3. So that's what we want to do. Okay, so let's prove this. And here is one lemma that we will state without proof, and of course I have a reference for the proof. Of course, if you come to my office, I can do it. So here's a lemma, which is going to tell us that with a very high probability, in fact, the rank of the element in here is going to be very close to this one. That's what the lemma is going to tell us. So the probability that the rank of Q in X is greater than the expected value, namely n over S times J, what we want to show is that the, if I look at the rank of this, so let me call that as minus n over j plus the absolute value is greater than n over square root of s square root 4 alpha mod n is less than or equal to n over minus. So this is actual value of the rank of this guy in that original set. And this is the expected value, n over s times j. So the absolute value of this cannot be greater than that with the very high probability. So the probability that it exceeds this value is very small. So this is a lemma that we would utilize. Then once you use the lemma, then we can readily prove that those two conditions we are looking for, L1 and L2, will hold. Right, so let's see how that is the case. Keep that in mind, and then let's just figure out, according to the lemma, what can we say about the rank of L1 and the rank of L2 in the set X, right? We just apply the lemma and see what happens. So here is my integer line that goes from 1 to n, and I want to know the rank of L1, so I want to know the rank. What is the expected rank of L1 in X? So the rank of the element L1 in the sample happens to be I times S over N minus square root of 4 alpha plus log n. Like this is the rank of L1 in S. So therefore, what is the expected rank of the element L1 in X? The expected value will be I times, I have to multiply this by n over s, which is going to give me n over square root of s, square root of 4 alpha log n. So we said 5, 5. Now, according to the lemma, we are going to get an interval, confidence interval, high confidence interval for the rank of L1 in X, right? So if I apply that lemma, then the lemma says that the rank of L1 is going to fall in between these two intervals with a very high probability. Namely, this one will be the expected value, I times N over square root of S, square root of 5 alpha log N, minus N over square root of S, square root of 4 alpha log N. And this endpoint is going to be I times N over square root of S, square root of 5 alpha log N. The expected value will be. So we have to just multiply by N over S. So which I did not do right, that is I minus N over square root of S, square root of 5 alpha log N. Right? That's the expected value. And the lemma is going to give us the confidence interval. High confidence interval, namely, it says that the absolute difference between the actual rank and the expected rank is no more than that, right? So therefore, this endpoint will be this plus that. So namely, I minus N over square root of S, square root of 5 alpha log N, plus N over square root of S, square root of 4 alpha log N. And then this endpoint is nothing but I minus N over square root of S, square root of 5 alpha log N, minus the same thing, N over square root of S, square root of 4 alpha. And that is this value. And this is this value. And this is a high confidence or high probability interval. So the lemma says that the rank of L1 is going to fall in between these two with a very high probability, right? That's basically what we just applied the lemma. We have not done anything else. So this is my expected value. Then I have to add plus or minus that quantity that the lemma is going to give me. So add that, and then I subtract that. So this endpoint and that endpoint. So the rank of L1 is going to be in between these two with a very high probability.
Where
does the square
root
come from in the sample size? Shouldn't be just normal S? Oh, you mean this one, right?
Yeah.
Because this is the actual rank of L1 in the sample. The expected value will be. So, expected value of rank of L1 in X is basically you multiply this whole thing by N over S.
Yeah.
Right? That's where we get I minus. If I do that, N over square root of S, and then square root of 5 alpha log. That's what we get, right?
Thank you.
Okay. We'll flip a coin. Okay.
So, my question is how to define the size of the sample, because if you have the range of L1, you have range of L2. How to make sure they are not overlapped?
Oh, yeah, right. Sure, yeah. We will fix the value of S. As I said, we can pick S to be into the 2/3, for example. You're right. So let's see. Notice that this value over here is strictly less than I. Of course, clearly, this is also less than I. And our I is going to be, say, somewhere in here. So let's call that I. Let's see the rank of L2. The rank of L2 is going to have a similar interval. So what is the expected rank of L2? And that is going to be I times I plus, rather, N over square root of S, square root of 5 alpha log N. right? That's the expected value of the key L2, the element L2 in X, expected rank of that. Then we can have an interval like we did for the other things. And this is our high probability interval. And this is our rank of L2. And this endpoint is going to be the same quantity minus that one. So I times I plus n over square root of s square root of phi alpha log n minus n over square root of s square root of 4 alpha. And likewise, this endpoint is going to be I times I plus n over square root of s square root of phi alpha log n plus n over square root of s, square root of 4 alpha. So the lemma says that the rank of L2 in X is going to be within this with a very high probability. Right? So we just applied the lemma for the two elements L1 and L2 and realized that we have a high confidence interval for L1, the rank of L1, the same thing for L2.
What does it mean? Why are you subtracting that probability from?
Oh, because that's what the lemma says, right? Namely, what the lemma says is that if I look at the difference between the two, the absolute value of the difference is no more than that.
Uh-huh.
Another way of saying that is that the rank of this is going to be the expected value plus this and the expected value minus this. So it's going to fall in between that interval with the very good form. So that's the implication of that.
Okay.
So the rank of this quantity over here is going to be this plus or minus that.
Okay.
With the high probability. And that is basically what we have done. So we have put the minus here and the plus here. And the same thing, the minus and the plus. And realize that the rank of L1 has to fall in between that interval with a high probability. So it's just application of the lemma, we haven't done anything else.
And for the expected value, why are we choosing n over s as the proportion to multiply it by?
Because we have only picked s elements out of the n elements.
Oh, okay.
So therefore, we would expect that the rank will be proportionally larger in the bigger set. As opposed to this.
Got it.
Okay, so any other questions? So this picture tells us everything that we want to know. Namely, for one thing, that the two elements L1 and L2 will bracket the I smallest element with a high probability, right? Because L1, the largest rank it can have, happens to be strictly less than I. Likewise, the smallest rank L2 can have is strictly greater than I. So therefore, we know that the rank of or the I smallest element is going to have a value in between L1 and L2. Moreover, what can we say about the number of elements that will have a value in between L1 and L2? So let's note the highest smallest element of X of X will be in between L1 and L2 with a high probability. And the second thing, we want to know how many elements are there in the input such that they have a value in between L1 and L2. So can we say something about this? So the number of elements will be basically
the number of elements.
Right. So that number, this number, right, minus that number. That's going to tell me how many elements will remain, again with a very high probability, right? So the number of elements will be then this one, namely I plus n over square root of s, square root of 5 alpha log n, plus n over square root of s, square root of 4 alpha log n. That number minus I minus n over square root of s, square root of 5 alpha log n, minus n over square root of s, square root of 4 alpha. And that is going to give me, the i's will cancel, and then we'll only be left with something like some constant times n over square root of s, square root of 1. So this number is looking very equal to 2 times n over square root of s, square root of 5 alpha log n, plus square root of 4 alpha n over square root of s. So that's what it is. With a high probability. I'm sorry.
Alpha is
alpha. So remember, we always keep the alpha as though it is a variable, but in practice we will substitute some value for alpha, like depending on how pessimistic or optimistic, right? What kind of a probability. So when we say high, with high probability, we mean a probability of at least 1 minus n to the minus.
So when we choose the sample, do we need have to consider the range is less than 1? I mean the rank. You want to find the i's rank, right? But
yeah.
Do you worry about if it is the ranges include i minus 1, i minus 2?
Oh, yeah. So that's a good question. Namely, the boundary cases, namely,
yeah,
when I is very small, like 1, 2, it may not even fall under this category. But I being very small or very large, they are very easy to handle. So the problem becomes more and more difficult when I becomes larger and larger toward n over 2. When we write a program, you're right. In fact, this program has been implemented by many of my students, and they always will handle the boundary cases slightly differently. When I is less than certain value, then they have a much simpler algorithm. If I is large enough, then they use this. Okay, so that is the size of the remaining elements. Therefore, what is the algorithm now? So let's summarize the algorithm. One is pick a sample, two, identify L1 and L2, let x, call x prime or whatever, x1 equal to q in x, such that L1 less than or equal to q less than L2. So in other words, we are throwing away all the elements that do not fall in between L1 and L2 because we are hoping that the remaining elements will contain the highest small sample. And so, for example, let x2 be equal to q in x such that q is strictly less than L1. Let the cardinal def x1 be equal to n1. Let the cardinal def x2 be equal to n1. One question is, okay, so at this point I'm going to throw elements which are not in the interval L1 and L2. How can I be sure that, for example, x1 indeed has the highest smallest element? What would be a test for that?
should be the size of this x1 should not be larger than I.
Excellent. And also the size of x1 and x2 should be greater than or equal to I. Right? Because I don't want to lose on the other side also. So there is a very easy test to check if I indeed have bracketed the I smallest element in x1 by just looking at the numbers n1 and n2. Right? N1 should be strictly less than I, and n1 plus n2 should be greater than or equal to I. So if these two hold, that means I have the I smallest element in x1, then I can go ahead and do a selection on x1. Right? That's how the algorithm works. So therefore, it's not a Monte Carlo algorithm, it is Las Vegas algorithm. So whenever I output an answer, it is the correct answer. Or is, if n1 is less than I, and n1 plus n2, if not, then start all over. The probability of this happening is very, very low. So if I do not, if I have not succeeded in keeping the I smallest element, then I'm going to give up and start all over again, meaning from the first sampling step. If indeed I have bracketed, but you may also want to make sure that the number of elements in x1 are not very large. That also you can put it as a condition. So if you are happy with the current sample, you can proceed further and then output select I minus n1, that smallest element in x1. That's how the rest of the algorithm works. Namely, you are going to use an algorithm to do a selection on that and then output. But the remaining elements will be very small in size, therefore you can even use any non-optimal algorithm. For example, you can use a BFPRD algorithm to finish off, because that's only lower order term. It's not going to matter. And as I said, let's fix the value of S to be n to the 2/3. So in this case, what can we say about the size of x1? X1 is going to be, you know, as it says here, n over square root of s, square root of log n. So with a very high probability, it's going to be n to the 2/3 square root of log n. So then what is the runtime of the algorithm? We promise something like n plus minimum of I comma n minus I. Is it going to have that behavior? Let's quickly do the number of comparisons, and then maybe we may have to spend 5 more minutes next time. So step one, how much time does it take? S time, which will be n to the 2/3, we go n to the 2/3, which is very negligible. And how about step two? So I have to find two elements, L1 and L2. How will I find those two elements in the sample? I can do two selections in that sample, right? Because I know the ranks of the two elements. So I will do one selection, find the L1. I do another selection, find L2. I can use BFPRT to do that. So therefore, I can find both L1 and L2 in big of n to the 2/3 time. And then I have to partition the input into you know, x1 and the remaining elements. So how many comparisons will I do? I want to have the constant. I want to calculate the constant exactly, right? The obvious way of doing it would be two comparisons per input element, that will be 2n comparisons, right? So we can do step 3 in 2n comparisons, and the step 4 takes only, you know, n to the 2/3 log n, this much amount of time. So just like that, step 4 takes big O n to the 2/3 log n time, square root of log n time. Again, negligible. All of these are negligible. The only key is how many comparisons do I do in step number 4. If we do it in the obvious way, we do spend 2n comparisons, but we promise something better, which is n plus minimum of I comma n minus I. So how do you do that, right? That's a nice trick. We will talk about it in the next time. So in the meantime, you can think about this and see how we can, okay.
Can you say it again, step 3? How much time step 3 takes?
Oh, you're right. For example, if you do it the obvious way, it will cost 2 comparisons per input element, right? For instance, take every input element, compare it with L1 and compare it with L2. Then I will know whether it falls in X1 or in X2 or outside of those two, right? So I only need two comparisons per input element, that will be 2n. But we don't want to spend 2n, we want to spend less than that. So we'll see how to do that in only n plus minimum of I comma n minus I comparisons, which is no more than 1.5 times n, right? N plus minimum of I comma n minus I is no more than 1.5 times n, which is better than 2n. So we'll see how to do that. And that is the, so then the rest of the steps are negligible. The only dominating step will be step number. So how do you obtain X1? So I'll stop here.
Do you think the reason behind N1 less than I, N1 plus 2 greater or equal to I?
Because I have taken my X and partitioned it into X1 and X2. So my X1 has all the elements that are less than L1. These are elements that are greater than or equal to L1. So I want the I-th smallest element to be in here. That means I want the number of elements here to be strictly less than I.
Okay.
And that's why I want N1 to be strictly less than I.
I see. Aren't there elements that fall outside of that range?
Yeah, there could be elements outside this.
Yeah, why would we consider that?
We don't care about that.
Why?
Because it's sufficient for us to only look at these two numbers and decide.
Right?
Okay. So yeah, there could be your X3. I want to make sure that I have the ith element in there. I can do that by just making sure that the number of elements here is strictly less than I. And if I add up the number of elements here and the number of elements here, that should be at least I.
Why?
So if that happens, I know that the ith smallest element is in there.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Alright.
So if the number of elements in here is less than I, right?
Uh-huh.
Then the I smallest element is not here. Right?
Uh-huh.
On the other hand, if the number of elements here plus the number of elements in here happen to be at least I, then I know that the ith element has to be in here. It is not in here, but it has to be. Therefore, it has to be in here.
I see. Thank you. Sorry.
Sure.
Sir, I have a question. So this is N1, right?
That is it.
So this should
be less than I.
But
N1
is this, right?
Oh, I think I switched the numbers. So what did I?
This is our
N2. You are right. The N2 has to be.
N2 has to be less than I.
I was thinking.
I was thinking how
it
can.
Oh yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
So yeah, the site by. X1, I mean this and X2.
Yeah.
I'll correct that.
This is really nice. Is this This is not, you said this was with, you came up with this with your professor, right? Right.
Yeah, this is again one of the things.
Okay.
Interesting.
You can probably, are we going to be covering parallel algorithms?
Oh yeah, we will do that. Yeah. In fact, if you look at the syllabus I gave in the first lecture, so parallel algorithms is one of the topics.
Oh, right, okay, I remember. Got it. Yeah, because that would
speed this.
Oh, thank you.